From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, it's award season in Hollywood, and some of the perks for voters are raising eyebrows. Then, Jad Abumrad has a new podcast about Dolly Parton. In the process of unpacking her history, he discovers something about his own.
Through Dolly, I understood my dad and his journey from Lebanon to America a whole lot better. So in the process of all of this, it became a really personal series for me.
And we wake up to Good Morning. That's not a salutation. It's the name of a band. All that coming up on The Frame. Hollywood's award season has gone full tilt, and that means movie studios and streaming services are working every possible angle and spending a ton of money to try to land the industry's most coveted trophy, an Academy Award. Last weekend, the Critics' Choice Association announced nominees for its awards, which will be handed out in a primetime broadcast in January. Netflix led the pack with a startling number of mentions for its films, which include The Irishman and Marriage Story. It's no secret that studios spend a lot to woo voters, but a Washington Post report explains how some campaigning might look like vote buying. Steven Zajcik covers the business of entertainment for the Post. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here, John.
So not all awards are the same. So let's talk about the Critics' Choice Association. Who are they and do they matter?
So this is a group of about 400 journalists, a very diverse group geographically, often online critics and broadcast critics. You know, in terms of the importance of this telecast, the ceremony, you know, look, obviously the Oscars and the Golden Globes take pride of place, but I think they get a fair number of viewers and people do take it seriously.
And as you said, it is a diverse group. There are some legitimate critics like Anne Hornaday from The Washington Post. There are critics from RogerEbert.com. Then there are people like Jimmy Hollywood from JimmyHollywood.com, a woman who calls herself the curvy critic, and a lot of bloggers. In terms of the organization, what is it that Netflix allegedly did with them to try to persuade them to vote or at least be aware of their films?
What Netflix has done in this case that seems to have really ruffled some feathers is actually taken this and turned it up to 11. What they've done is they've flown a number of journalists from this group from various places around the country to both Los Angeles and New York to give them essentially private audiences with a lot of the stars. And so a lot of people around the industry are crying foul, saying it's one thing if we're hosting a party or an event or a panel and, you know, we're inviting people from the press, inviting people from various voting groups. It's quite another if you're flying them around the country, putting them up in some cases at very nice hotels like the Four Seasons or the Beverly Hilton and trying to entice their vote that way.
We're talking with Washington Post reporter Steven Zajcik about how studios and Netflix are campaigning for awards attention. I know a member of the board of directors of the Critics' Choice Association. I won't say his name, but about 8 years ago, I asked him about his company's policy about taking free trips. And he said, we have a very strict policy. As long as somebody else is paying, we'll take the trip. And I don't think he was kidding. So how is this different from the Hollywood junket gravy train, which is essentially what studios do where they bring out people from small radio stations and maybe TV outlets? They come out to Hollywood, they do roundtable conversations, and often their trips are paid for. Isn't there like a Hollywood history here? How is the Netflix model different?
Well, it's a very good question. And I think certainly Netflix supporters and Netflix itself would argue that we are simply extending the junket model, basically saying, you know, instead of a traditional Jumanji is coming out, this is just the same thing, but for award season. I think the distinction a lot of people I've talked to made, and that, you know, people can make up their mind for themselves, is that this wasn't a traditional junket. There was no real pretense here even of coverage being generated. These were movies that were not going to be written about by these folks. These were, you know, mainly just boondoggles, as we like to call them in the business, where people just get free trips. They come in, they have a breakfast, they meet some stars, they take some selfies, and they go home. And I think that's a real look. You could debate whether junkets are valid or not, and certainly that's a healthy debate to have. But I think according to the people who are criticizing Netflix, there's a real distinction between what a junket is and what's been happening here.
How big is the organization and how many of its members are allegedly participating in these free trips?
Right. So that's been sort of what's interesting and hard to kind of get your head around, which is this something that's sort of running rampant within the organization, or is this something that individual members are doing in a more scattered fashion? So there are about 400 people who are voting members, although I've talked to a number of them, fairly high profile critics who say, you know what, I don't always even get a chance to vote. I'm not very active. And then, you know, there are people who, of course, more active. We did reporting on a number of the trips. There was on one of them, we were able to establish there are about 40 people, at least 40 people, maybe a few more taking the trip. That was for the two popes, I believe. The Irishman, which was a more elaborate event with a very splashy premiere. That one might have been a little bit bigger. We didn't get an exact number on that. But, you know, again, when you're talking about 40 or 50 people in a group of several hundred, you know, it's not everyone, but it's certainly not a small percentage.
There's obviously the payoff in terms of prestige that a studio or a streaming service can get from Academy Award nominations or wins. But from a streaming service, how does it actually affect what would be the movie studio equivalent of box office? What is the upside for a company like Netflix to not only get Critics' Choice Award nominations, but Academy Award attentions? How does that translate into viewers or maybe subscribers?
Well, you're hitting on a really interesting point here, which is, well, broadly and existentially, is what is the point of award season? You know, what does any studio get out of this, and what does a Netflix get out of it? You know, I think when it comes to a traditional studio, you're right to point out box office. This is often used as a tool to get attention, get some publicity for your movie. If 20 million people are watching the Golden Globes, or 35 or 40 million people are watching the Oscars, or even the Critics' Choice, a smaller number, that's going to get folks to go out and buy tickets and see your movies. Netflix doesn't have that. Netflix is trying to get subscribers to their service. That's a far more indirect goal than what these other studios are doing. But we talked to a few analysts, and what they pointed out, and I thought it was really, really notable, is that, you know, Netflix really doesn't have a lot of metrics by which to judge their success. You know, we don't know what their box office is. We don't know individual movies, whether they're profitable or not. We can all guess at it, but we don't really have those usual metrics. So awards and the volume of awards becomes very significant for them. And I think that's why one reason they've been very dogged in pursuing it.
Steven Zajcik covers the business of entertainment for The Washington Post. Steve, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Always good to be here, John. Thank you.
Coming up on The Frame, Jad Abumrad on the discovery that led to his new podcast, Dolly Parton's America. Of course, you know Dolly Parton as a singer and actor, but she's also a prolific songwriter. She's written nearly 3,000 songs in her more than 50 years of making music. And not only that, as Dolly has grown older, her fans have grown younger and more diverse. The new podcast, Dolly Parton's America, tries to understand the unifying force behind the self-deprecating artist who wrote a song called Backwoods Barbie. Jad Abumrad is the host of the podcast. You might know him from the public radio show Radiolab. Throughout the series, he makes the case that Dolly's music has something important to say about the current state of our country. Jad's connection to Parton goes back to his own childhood growing up in Nashville.
It was not the Nashville of now. The Nashville of now is this hipster wonderland that is like the southern Brooklyn, right? But at the time when I was there, it was not that. It was a kind of like moderately big city that was definitely wrapped in southern culture. And so as a Lebanese kid, I didn't like feel that welcome there. I left Nashville with a certain narrative in my mind about that place and what that place was and what it meant to me. And one of the background motivations for me in doing this series was to go back to Nashville and actually like look at it in a more truthful way.
And it's worth noting, too, that were it not for your father, this podcast might not have happened.
That's exactly right. I mean, 2013, Dolly is with her manager, I believe, and her friend Judy Ogle. And they're in a big black SUV. They get into a minor car accident. She's taken to Vanderbilt Hospital. And my dad happened to be on call that day. He's a doctor. And then they just kind of quickly transitioned to being pals. But it was always this kind of weird background question, like, what on earth could they have in common? I mean, she's like a global pop star, and he's just like a guy. You know, he's just like he's an amazing doctor, an amazing guy, but he's not someone that hangs out with famous people. And then independent of that, I became interested in Dolly in 2016 This was during the election, during sort of right at the very moment where Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were just like in an all-out brawl. And at that very moment, Dolly comes to Queens and does a stadium show.
I want you to know that I will always love you.
And I remember how thrilled everybody was around me, where every different kind of American was present.
Fans, because, I mean, wouldn't it be great if everybody in this whole world could just have as much love as we've had here tonight?
You had people of faith standing next to men in drag, standing next to guys in trucker hats. And everybody was polite. Everyone was getting along, and everybody was singing to the same song. Like, that was really interesting to me. So I got interested in her because of that concert. I had a way to get to her now through my dad. And so then that's kind of how the whole thing was born. And interestingly, I ended it, like, there was a moment where I, through Dolly, I understood my dad and his journey from Lebanon to America a whole lot better.
I want to play a moment from the fourth episode. It's called Neon Moss, and it's when you go to visit Dolly's mountain home.
Ooh, there's a snake. Hello, big black snake. I spent maybe 10 minutes just kind of wandering around, half expecting a bear to come stumbling out of the woods.
There were bears all over the place. There were bears just running around everywhere.
And bears aside, the whole time, I couldn't shake this feeling like I had been here before.
I want to ask about that idea about familiar in an unfamiliar place. What were you getting at there?
We got to go to Dolly's Tennessee Mountain home, which is sort of, you heard a clip of us walking around the grounds there. And just to put that in context, I mean, I think you'll understand this because of your natural roots, but Dolly's Tennessee Mountain home is like hallowed ground in the South.
In my Tennessee mountain home.
You know, it's the subject of, I don't know, 20, 30 of her songs, anthems, Southern anthems. And so it's like this mythic place. It's like Tennessee Valhalla, right? We ended up going there, and I didn't even think it existed. I thought it was just sort of an idea at this point, but we ended up going there. And so we ended up walking around, and the thing that really struck me that you heard a bit of there is that her home, it looked eerily similar to my dad's Lebanese mountain home, which was just a shack in the mountains, almost the exact same elevation. That sort of layering of one experience on another led me to have a conversation with my dad where, you know, he basically explained to me, like, in a bunch of different ways, like, this is what Dolly Parton and I have in common. Like, she is this kind of the transcendent goddess of our pain and loss of home. And so that was a real eye-opening thing for me to see that their experiences could be mirrored. She's singing songs about Lebanon even when singing songs about Tennessee.
It feels like the subtitle of this podcast could be Challenging Assumptions. And it's a lot of assumptions that you have about who Dolly Parton is and what her music means. And I'm wondering, as you're reporting this and spending time with her, what were the things that you assumed to be true that you were really, I guess, wrong about?
I grew up with a very narrow image of Dolly Parton. You know, like, I knew the song Jolene, I knew the song 9 to 5, but mostly what I knew of her is that she would go on, like, late-night TV.
The last time I brought my melons to the Big Apple.
David Letterman would, like, joke about her breasts, and then she would joke about her breasts, and she was just this, like, kind of hilarious, larger-than-life persona.
I had to do one of your jokes for you.
Whoa, but buddy!
Like, that was kind of what I knew of her. That was sort of my starting point. But then when I actually sat down with her and we went kind of album by album through her discography, like, the first thing that hits you is, oh my God, she has written a lot of music. Like, oh my God, going back to 1966, 67, you realize this is one of the great songwriters of our era. And she hasn't really been given her due as a songwriter. You know, people talk about her as this, like, cultural figure, as this, these days you hear her talked about as a feminist, you hear her talked about as a businesswoman. But I feel like, one of the stories that I hope will be told in the next few years, and we certainly tried to tell in the podcast, is, like, this is somebody who deserves to be put on par with Bob Dylan. Like, the number of songs that she's written for as long as she's written them, that blew me away. That was one of the many things that really ultimately surprised me. But then the surprises just kept unfurling from there.
We're talking with Jad Abumrad about his podcast, Dolly Parton's America. I want to play a little bit from a song of hers called Wildflowers.
I just long to be gone, so the garden one day set me free. I hitched a ride with the wind, and since he was my friend.
So here's the lyric. I never felt right in a garden so different from me. I just never belonged. I just longed to be gone. And you could say outwardly, it's not an anthem about being a misfit, about being gay or lesbian. It's about being who you are. And yet her music is so resonant in the LGBTQ community. A couple of years ago, we ran a piece on our show about Our Lady J, who's a trans writer who found hope in Dolly's music. And one of the guests on your podcast is the bluegrass banjo player Justin Hiltner. And I think his story is that he's listening to a lot of Dolly's music at the same time he's coming out.
Yeah, I mean, it was a real eye-opening that, you know, he grew up in a strongly evangelical family in rural Ohio, and he was homeschooled for religious reasons. And so there was literally no space in his life for being outwardly gay. And he talks about the moment he came out, and he came out while learning a Dolly song called Silver Dagger, which is a beautiful song, and he sings it just like heartbreakingly beautifully on the podcast.
Don't sing love songs, you'll wake my mother.
Like, that's an old ballad that Dolly recorded on one of her bluegrass albums that's about a mother trying to prevent her daughter from leaving the house and getting married, because her mother knows how bad men can be and doesn't want her daughter to be treated badly. It's a song that on the surface has nothing to do with being a gay man. But at that very same moment, Justin describes being trapped in his house. And his parents would not let him leave the house, would not let him have a cell phone, would not let him have a driver's license. Like, he had a silver dagger over his head as well. And so she has a spooky ability to write songs which seem to be about one thing, but can so easily be transposed to be about something else. Wildflower, as you mentioned, is exactly that way. It's a song about being a weirdo. And Justin describes listening to that song on a loop as he ran away from home, basically. He got in a car, drove from Ohio to Nashville, and Wildflower was sort of his private anthem. That's one of her great gifts, I think, is to sort of write songs that have that kind of layered universality that anyone could see their story in it.
I want to ask you this last thing. You have an episode about Dolly's politics, and here's something that she said about Donald Trump.
If we're having all these problems, why don't we just pray for Mr. President? You know, it's like, I wanted to say that, but I thought, no, keep your damn mouth shut. So, tit joke. When all else fails, be funny, or try to be funny.
And there's a moment where you really are wrestling with what it is that she has to say. And I think we all want to figure out what people's positions are on certain things. And I think you come to this conclusion, she will not cast anybody out. What did you take away from that idea? Because it's not an idea that a lot of people share right now.
No, I found that moment sitting in the room with her. I didn't take that to mean, let's pray for the president because I support him. I think what she meant was, like, even if you don't believe in God, which I'll admit to you, I don't, even if you think the president is a madman, which you can probably guess how I feel about that, shouldn't you still pray for him? You know, even with those two things, like shouldn't we still pray for all Americans, all people to be their best selves, even if we secretly want to stick a knife in their heads? Like, for me, that there was something about forgiveness and about transcendence there that was deeply moving. And it felt like a message from a higher plane, to be honest.
Jad Abumrad's podcast is called Dolly Parton's America. Jad, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Dolly Parton's America is available through your favorite podcast source. Up next on The Frame, a band from Australia that's quietly built a huge following in the States. If you search the words Good Morning Band on the internet, you'll get an endless number of morning news shows with bands performing on them. But what you won't find is the Australian indie rock duo called Good Morning. Despite drawing no significant media attention in the United States, they've somehow garnered millions of plays on Spotify, many by fans on the West Coast. Last month, they played multiple sold-out shows in Los Angeles during their first U.S. tour, and that's when we caught up with them.
Hi, I'm Stefan from the band Good Morning.
And I'm Liam, also from the band Good Morning. We met in high school in, must be 2010, I want to say. We hit it off pretty quickly. We had mutual friends. We knew each other sort of vaguely. Mm. And then I think there was a free dress day where you were wearing like a band t-shirt. There was probably some like smart ass comments, and that was probably the start of it. Shortly after that, we started writing songs and sending each other demos, just for fun, really. Eventually, one day, we thought it'd be a good idea to put out a record of some of those songs, and it has pretty much just escalated from there. I think the way we've been able to get to America has been just organically, or yeah, whatever the 2019 version of organically is, just through
people,
the internet.
People sharing music.
There is this strange thing where with this like Spotify and YouTube and stuff, you can see, especially West Coast America, I don't know what it is about the West Coast, but
yeah,
we could see that people were listening to it here.
Yeah,
we just took our time to get here, I guess. I think that it's kind of our preferred method of working, is to work quickly and have fun while we're doing it.
It'd be great to make something that's super polished, but I don't think we have the capabilities like on our own. So,
yeah, I think I like the feeling of something that feels kind of like a first take or that hasn't been labored over. I thought I was winning. I thought I was winning.
Sub was actually written super quickly. What is the cause of my submission? Is it in my past? Is it in my future? Or is it me? I think it's just born out of a lot of like social anxiety, and like the idea of conversation and hanging out with people terrifies me. But I need to remember that I'm capable of it. It was sort of like a reminder to stick up for myself in a way. I just feel like I can be very submissive and just like will accept whatever's going on. But sometimes it's good to state your feelings and speak up for yourself and look after yourself in a way. Yeah.
It's important. So everyone needs a reminder on that sometimes.
Yeah. Coming in hot, right off the top. I may as well have crashed into you.
You are the best supporting actor. Best supporting actor is a love song about my boyfriend. One of the first Good Morning love songs. It's been a recent development that we now have love songs in our, requited love songs in our catalogue. And that's all it is. It's just a simple love song. I was trying to see if I could write one. And I did.
And you did it.
I also got really into the... I wanted to make a song about winning, like, awards. I got really into the concept of, like, awards shows and ceremonies for a while. The idea that you can win, like, an award for being a like, regular boyfriend is just funny to me. But I'll give you space, my kiss your face. if we had to have some kind of band ethos for Good Morning, it would just be that life is messy and it's never one way or the other. It's never great. It's never bad. It's always everything. And I think that's like what our music tries to bring across. Life is messy and that's good.
That segment was produced by our intern, Paul Ratliff, who finished his time with us this week. Thanks for everything, Paul, and good luck. And that'll do it for today. Thanks to the team that produces The Frame and to Taylor McFerrin, who provides our opening theme music. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here Monday at the Moen Broadcast Center.